Welcome to our Brihad Bhagavatamrita course. Thank you all for attending. A few formalities to begin with. We have an attendance sheet here. Please mark yourself present. If your name is not here, then just write it in the next space down and mark yourself present, and just keep passing it around until everyone has signed in. Well, it's very nice that we're here in Sri Vrindavan Dham and in this very sacred environment we are able to study the Shastras, the writings left to us by our great acharyas and by Krishna himself. So, particularly, we're going to be studying Brihad Bhagavatamrita, which was written here in Vrindavan some 450 or 60 years ago, or 440 perhaps years ago. It is a book which is establishing the glory of Sri Vrindavan Dham and of the inhabitants of Sri Vrindavan Dham. So what better place to study it than in Sri Vrindavan Dham? It's a very interesting book. Is written by Srila Sanatan Goswami, the eldest of the six Goswamis and one of our very great acharyas in our line. There are two parts to the book. So the first part we'll be studying for the first 2 weeks. The second part for the second 2 weeks. We will have a test at the end of the first 2 weeks and at the end of the second 2 weeks. Each test will be devoted just to the subject matters that we have been through in that particular 2 weeks. We have our study guide. If you haven't got one, then you should get one from the VIHE office. I think it's very important, really. The importance will be more in the sense that I would like you in the evenings, please, and just for your benefit, really, to read through the chapter discussing what we're going to be talking about the following day, so that you know, at least you have a reasonable idea where we will be going in the discussion and what subjects are going to be covered there. The chapters are not long, 1, 2, or 3 pages usually, so it's not more than 15 minutes or so to read through. You could even make a few notes. The idea, as I said, is just to tune in, really, to what we're going to be discussing the following day. So, other than that, there won't be homework, but I think it would be good, as I said, if you would please do that. And in this way you'll be ready. Now, the work is written by Srila Sanatan Goswami. Let us begin by reading a prayer to Srila Sanatan Goswami, written by Srila Raghunath Das Goswami. It's a very nice glorification of Sanatan Goswami. And it'll help us perhaps to feel a little appreciation for this great devotee as we just enter in to this work, which is really the greatest of all his works, this Brihad Bhagavatamrita. So Srila Raghunath Das Goswami says, Vairagyug Bhakti Rasam Prayatnayar Apayayan Mam Anabipsumandam Kripam Budir Ya Paradukadu Ki Sanatanas Tam Prabhum Ashrayami. I was unwilling to drink the nectar of devotional service, possessed of renunciation. But Sanatan Goswami, out of his causeless mercy, made me drink it, even though I was unable to do so. Therefore, he is an ocean of mercy. He is very much compassionate to fallen souls like me. And thus, it is my duty to offer my respectful obeisances unto his lotus feet and to take shelter of him. This is a very nice verse written by Srila Raghunath Das Goswami, glorifying Srila Sanatan Goswami, the author of Brihad Bhagavatamrita. Just a little background on Sanatan Goswami. Just by looking around, I can see that most of you, I know most of you, I think, at least more than half of you, or almost all of you. So I know that most of you are fairly experienced in Krishna consciousness. So Sanatan Goswami, you are not newcomers to Sanatan Goswami or the six Goswamis. But still, I can just say a little bit about Sanatan Goswami, just as I said in regard to that verse by Raghunath Das Goswami, just so we can enter into his book with some little sense of appreciation for this great soul. So Srila Sanatan Goswami, he appeared in the year 1488. So this means that he is 2 years or so younger than Lord Chaitanya. They're almost the same age, an approximate 2 year difference. Rupa Goswami appeared in 1493. So that means he's 5 years younger than Sanatan Goswami and, well, 7 years or so younger than Lord Chaitanya. And then Anupam, their other brother, was some years younger, and he's the father of Jiva Goswami. So Sanatan Goswami and actually Srila Rupa Goswami, they, from their childhoods, they showed themselves to be very brilliant young men, to the point that they became nationally renowned in Bengal as great scholars and great intellectuals. They were great linguists. They understood Bengali, of course, was their mother tongue, but they understood Sanskrit completely fluently. They understood Persian, Arabic. These are the languages of the rulers of that time. The Muslims were ruling. Hussein Shah was ruling Bengal at that time. And they knew other languages. Plus, they were just very intelligent. Thank you. Did everyone mark themselves present, incidentally? Anyone not? So let us hope you did. So they're very clever people, and they became nationally renowned for their intelligence, expertise, culture, and just their ability to do everything with extreme cleverness, expertise, intelligence, maturity, and so on. To the point that their reputations came to the ears of the king, Hussein Shah, and he basically drafted them into his service. There wasn't much they could say. He said, I'll give you two choices. Either you come and work for me, or I'll, you know, kill your families or things like this and abuse you and your families, so you can choose. So they were forced to work for him. And Sanatan Goswami, he became known as Sakara Malik, which translates to something like prime minister or personal secretary, very, very close personal assistant and advisor. It's like that. Yeah. So he was the personal secretary. Srila Prabhupada describes him sometimes as prime minister, but it appears to be a little more specific as personal secretary, not in the sense that he would just be, you know, taking down dictation and that kind of secretary, but intimate advisor. And, you know, the king would just always bounce things off him and get his opinion. Yeah. So that he was very close, or the king at least was extremely dependent upon him, and the king just would not let him practically out of his sight. He really became dependent upon him. After some time, Sanatan Goswami, he wanted to give that up. He was a devotee from childhood. There are descriptions in Bhakti Ratnakara of how he and Rupa and Anupam, they would play. And their only play would be Vrindavan Leela. Yeah, just like Lord Nityananda and his friends, they would play, but they wouldn't play the ordinary, you know, rather sort of pointless games of children, but they would reenact Vrindavan Leelas. Of course, not all children's games, I guess, are pointless, but, you know, they would play, you know, these really extraordinary games, put it that way. Reenacting the pastimes of the Lord. So they were devotees from birth. And during their childhood and their early years, and while they were working for the king, their Krishna consciousness was there. Absolutely. So after some time, they became frustrated, Rupa and Sanatan, with working for the king. So they tried to sort of ease themselves out of it. And there's a description how basically Sanatan Goswami, he decided to just take sick leave, permanent sick leave. So he stayed at home, and every day he would just send in a message saying, sick, sorry. Until the king himself came personally to see what is going on here. And the king told him, you know, you can't go on like this. King could see he wasn't sick. He was surrounded by devotees having a big Krishna Katha. Hussein Shah said, look, you know, it's obvious you're not sick. You've got to come back and work for me. Otherwise, I'll lock you up, or I may have to just kill you or something. Yeah. So Sanatan, in fact, got locked up. And we don't want to go into all the details, and probably you are familiar with the stories anyway. But he very cleverly got out, and very cleverly, despite various difficulties, got away and joined up with Rupa, and they met Lord Chaitanya in Varanasi and surrendered to Lord Chaitanya there. And that was that. Then they were part of the team of Lord Chaitanya. So after some time, Lord Chaitanya sent both of them here to Vrindavan and told them basically to do two things. One was to write, and the other was to uncover the lost holy places. So back in those days, Vrindavan was not like the way we see it. When Lord Chaitanya came, which was just a few years before they came, the local people living at Radhakund didn't even know what was Radhakund, what to speak of, where was Radhakund. So things were very, very much covered over. Sanatan and Rupa, they underwent great austerities, traveling around Vrajmandala, living under the trees, and uncovering so many holy places, and establishing shrines and temples, in some cases, as in Vrindavan town. And it would be correct to say that probably not less than 90% of the holy places which we see are there because of the work of Rupa and Sanatan, either directly or indirectly. Either they located them themselves, or perhaps some of their very intimate associates located some of the places. But really, the great, great majority of the work to reveal Vrindavan to the world was done by Rupa and Sanatan. So we owe them a great debt. He worshipped Madan Mohan at the temple down by the Parikrama path. He worshipped Madan Mohan. He wrote a number of important books. Brihad Bhagavatamrita is probably the most important. He also wrote Hari Bhakti Vilas, and he wrote a very amazing commentary on the 10th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. I've read most of the commentaries of most of the our important acharyas on the 10th canto, but in my opinion, for what it's worth, Sanatan Goswami's commentary, at least it struck me more, I could say that, than any of the other commentaries of our previous acharyas on the 10th canto. Very illuminating and very beautifully presented. So, these are some of the contributions of Srila Sanatan Goswami. So, he wrote Brihad Bhagavatamrita. And we are now going to launch into it. Before we start going into the structure of the book, so we know what we're looking at and how he has presented things, first of all, I will read to you his Mangala Charana. He has written an 11 or 12 verse Mangala Charana to this Brihad Bhagavatamrita. Mangala Charana is there, well, to establish auspiciousness at the beginning of a literary work, but also, in fact, at the beginning of Chaitanya Charitamrita, Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami, he explains what is a Mangala Charana and what are the specific functions. There are three main functions of a Mangala Charana. First is to define the subject matter of the book. Second is to offer respects to one's, whoever, like one's spiritual master, the Supreme Lord, and whoever one might feel like offering respect to. And third is to offer blessings, generally to the audience to the readers. These are the three main functions of a Mangala Charana, according to Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami. So let us just read these 12 verses here. First 12 verses of Brihad Bhagavatamrita, and just try to catch a little bit the mood of Sanatan Goswami himself as he approaches this great book. So he says, "All glories to that inconceivable Lord who descended to bestow the gift of perfect love for his own lotus feet. He is an ocean filled with many kinds of sweetness, and he always bears the fragrance of fresh youth. In his form as Sri Chaitanya, he has realized the last extreme of transcendental experience, the love residing eternally in the gopis. All glories above all to the gopis, headed by Sri Radhika, who are famous as the most dear devotees of the Lord. No one can even begin to properly describe the charm of their supreme affection for Sri Hari. Realizing that the ecstasy of his beloved devotees is even sweeter than his own, out of greed, the Lord descended to this world in the form of his own devotee, dressed as a renunciant, golden in effulgence. He bears the name Sri Krishna Chaitanya. All glories to that Lord Hari, who has appeared as the son of Mother Sachi. All glories to Goddess Mathura Devi, the best of holy cities. She attracts the mind. She is most dear to the enemy of Kamsa, and she is adorned with the Lord's birthplace. Mathura is acclaimed throughout the world for dispelling misery and bestowing liberation and devotion. And that is without mentioning the various pastimes the Lord has displayed there. All glories to this place where we are living, Lord Murari's Vrindavan forest. He prefers residing here to residing in Vaikuntha or in the hearts of elevated saints. In Vrindavan, while always tending his cows, he gives pleasure to the gopis, whose love for him in the mood of the rasa dance he increases by sweetly playing his flute. All glories to Sri Yamuna, the daughter of the sun god and sister of Yamaraj. She is beloved to Krishna, the killer of Mura. She has made friends with Mathura district and has exceeded the greatness of Ganga Devi. On the pretext of being a river, she carries the nectar flowing from Lord Sri Krishna's lotus feet. All glories to Govardhan, the emperor of lordly mountains. The Lord's dear gopis called him the best of Hari's servants. Krishna personally disrupted Indra's sacrifice to worship Govardhan instead, and then the hill resided for a week on the Lord's lotus palm. All glories to Sri Krishna's Prema Bhakti. Knowing that the feet of Prema Bhakti secretly comprise all the truths of the Vedas, liberation herself has come to worship her. Liberation, abandoned by the Vaishnavas, is eager to have the shelter of Prema Bhakti. Now, liberation has given up her dependence on mantras, penance, sacrifice, and renunciation. All glories to Lord Murari in the form of his all-ecstatic name. If any living being puts aside such tasks as meditation, ritual worship, and social duties, and even once takes the Lord's holy name, the name will grant him liberation. That holy name is the greatest source of eternal pleasure and is my only livelihood and ornament. I bow down to Sri Krishna Chandra, the reservoir of unconditional mercy. In this modern age, he has appeared as Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to distribute the taste of pure love. And this is now the final verse of the Mangala Charana. This book collects the essence of the scriptures teaching devotional service rendered to the Supreme Lord. These essential teachings I have personally realized under the shelter of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. I received them from his dear devotee, Sri Rupa. This is the Mangala Charana of Srila Sanatana Goswami for his book, Brihad Bhagavatamrita. So now, what is Brihad Bhagavatamrita then? Actually, it is described on page 1 and the top of page 2 in your study guides. The study guides were written originally by His Holiness Bhakti Charu Swami Maharaj. I have just made some slight alterations in some places, or just added some bits, really, in some places. Otherwise, it is as presented by Maharaj. It is quite condensed, I must say, but it certainly gives the basic outline. So now, in the introduction, he explains that this book is divided in two parts, Purva, preliminary, or the first part, and Uttar, final. The first part is called Sri Bhagavat Kripa Niyadhara, or Determining the Greatest Recipient of the Lord's Mercy. And the second part is called Establishing the Glory of Goloka Vrindavan. Yes, so in the broadest form, that is the nature of Brihad Bhagavatamrita. There are two parts. There are two quite separate stories. Each has its own main character. In the first part, which is about determining the greatest recipient of the Lord's mercy, the central character is Narada Muni. Narada Muni goes on a quest to find this person or these people. Who has received the most mercy from the Supreme Personality of Godhead? So he visits various devotees and he talks with them, and gradually those devotees, through discussion with them, he becomes directed higher and higher and higher up the line, you could say, towards those topmost devotees who are the devotees who are the greatest recipients of the Lord's mercy. Now, what does this mean, the greatest recipients of the Lord's mercy? You know, really what it indicates is who are the greatest devotees. The Lord is not, of course the Lord also is causeless with his giving of mercy. That is there. But then at the same time, the Lord does give his mercy in a reciprocal sense, as he says in Bhagavad Gita, Ye yatamam prapajyante tams tataiva bhajamyaham. As they surrender to me, I reciprocate accordingly. So even though, on one hand, it can be said that the Lord's mercy is causeless, but at the same time, There's also another perspective, that is, that he gives more mercy to the more advanced devotees. And if we look at it in that way, then when we determine who has been the greatest recipient of the Lord's mercy, we are determining who are the greatest devotees. And in fact, that becomes vividly clear as we go step by step through his sequence of encounters with different devotees gradually going up to higher and higher levels. Yes, so that is the nature of the first part. Then the second part, you know, if you really think about it, it's sort of like the same thing, in a sense, or very intimately connected at least. Second part is establishing the glory of Goloka Vrindavan, or what is determining what is the highest abode. Now, the highest abode, if you think about it, you would imagine the highest abode is where the people who have got the most mercy from the Lord live. Or in other words, the highest abode is where the greatest devotees live. And yes, that's true. So these two stories are very intimately connected with each other, really. Although there's also a difference in that ultimately the second part is establishing the glory of Goloka. Goloka Vrindavan. Yes. And at the end of the first part, he determines that, of course, there's no real prize for guessing who might be the greatest recipients, but he determines that the gopis, who at that time, because this particular narration took place when Maharaj Yudhisthira was ruling as the king, so he determines that the greatest recipients of the Lord's mercy are the gopis who at that time were living here in Gokula Vrindavan. So in the second part, the final determination is that Goloka Vrindavan is the topmost abode. And Gokula is not different, but that's because it's an extension of Goloka. So ultimately the glory is with Goloka, and Gokula's glory is there because of the glory of Goloka. So, yeah, in the first part, Narada Muni, trying to figure out who is the greatest devotee, who's got the most mercy, goes from one devotee to another. In the second part, he goes from one place to another and meets the devotees in the places. And sometimes the Lord who's living in the places and gradually determines, you know, to go to the next place, like that. This is basically how the book is structured. In both parts, he begins on planet Earth with some devotees, sort of like regular devotees, you could say, on this planet, gradually goes up to higher planetary systems within this universe, then goes out of the universe into the spiritual realm, into the Brahma Jyoti, and then beyond the Brahma Jyoti. Sometimes he comes back to this planet. I mean, it depends on the story, but in the second story, the central character comes back sometimes to this planet. Yes, so this is the basic structure. Now, just going back to the introduction in your study guide, You'll see here that in each part there are 7 chapters. So, like, we're going to begin right now. We'll begin going through the first chapter. And it is titled, in fact, Earthly. That is what Sanatana Goswami has called it. Earthly. So here, Narada Muni, our investigator, he is going to meet 2 devotees on this planet. At the end, the second one is going to direct him to the heavenly planets, and he's going to visit 2 of the heavenly planets tomorrow. Tomorrow we'll go to the heavenly planets and then move on from there. Okay, so let us begin. Let us begin, before we go into the actual details of the subject, the story itself of Narada Muni, trying to find the greatest recipient of the Lord's mercy. There is a context within which this book is spoken. Just like in the Bhagavatam, you're familiar that the Bhagavatam is essentially Suta Goswami speaking to the sages in Naimasharanya. But there's a context. The context is that he is relating what he heard Shukadev say to Maharaj Parikshit. Now here, the context is that the son of Maharaj Parikshit, his name was Janmajaya. The son of Maharaj Parikshit, he has just heard Mahabharat from Jaimini. Jaimini is a great Vedic sage, big Shastric authority. So Jaimini has just recited Mahabharat to Janmajaya, the son of Maharaj Parikshit. And at the end, Janmajaya, he is so inspired. He wants to hear more. He wants to understand more. So Jaimini says, yes, I can tell you more. He says, you know, I was personally present when your father, Maharaj Parikshit, heard Srimad Bhagavatam from Shukadev Goswami. I was there and I heard the whole conversation myself. And a very interesting thing happened. That was at the end of the recitation by Shukadev, and before the snake bird came and killed your father, your grandmother, Uttara, your grandmother approached Maharaj Parikshit in anxiety, understanding that it's now the 7th day and, you know, we expect this curse to take effect. So you're just about to pass away. She was very much in anxiety. But still, even though she was in anxiety, she was still a very advanced lady. So she asked Maharaj Parikshit, please tell me, what is the essence of what you've just heard from Shukadev? What is really, you know, the most essential part of it? What does it mean? Can you tell me that? So then, Maharaj Parikshit tells his mother, Utra, all right, I will explain what I have learned, the essential message of what I've learned. I will explain it in the form of a story. Or, actually, it ends up being two stories. So what is that? Well, who are the greatest recipients of the Lord's mercy? And what is the topmost abode? And actually, all the essential things connected with both. So then, Maharaj Parikshit, he starts telling, in this first part, the story of Narada Muni and his quest to find the recipients of the Lord's greatest mercy. So this is the context. Now, Sanatana Goswami, where does he come into it? Has he just written it? Is it like a novel or something? Well, we wouldn't take it like that. In fact, he himself, he says, these essential teachings I've personally realized under the shelter of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So it appears that Sanatana Goswami is getting some revelation here, that this is where these stories are coming from. Not that he has sort of made up like an allegorical or metaphorical story or something, you know, like the story of Paranjan, just to make some points. And, you know, you have your points worked out beforehand and you create a story that fits around the points so that the points are illustrated and drawn out as effectively as possible. It appears to not be like that, but rather that Sanatana Goswami has realized this and that, in fact, these stories are quite historically correct. They actually happened. And this is borne out further. Well, first of all, you know, we would assume Sanatana Goswami, great devotee like that, he would only present truly bona fide absolute truth to us, no concoctions. But secondly, very interesting point is that he has written a commentary, lengthy commentary to the book, to every verse, just as Prabhupada has written his purports to Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam. So Srila Sanatana Goswami has written his purports. If it was just his book, why would he bother writing purports? You know, purport means another person generally comes along and elucidates or expands on the original text. If it was, the whole thing was just his original text, he could put everything in the story itself without bothering with commentary. But he's done this elaborate commentary. Yeah. So this is the background then. Maharaj Parikshit is explaining to his mother, Uttara, the most important facts, realizations, the most important understandings he got from hearing Srimad Bhagavatam. That is, that there are some people who are the greatest devotees and they have received the most of the Lord's mercy. And there is the place, there is a place which is the highest abode. And we should aim for that. And we should follow in the footsteps of Guru's greatest devotees and also try and get some of that mercy which they got by their mercy. And this is basically Maharaj Parikshit is saying, this is what I got, the message I got when I heard Srimad Bhagavatam. Okay, so now, enough with the background. Let us go into the story. So, a group of sages have gathered at Prayag, at Dash Ashvamedha Ghat. This is the main ghat in Prayag, which is very famous for all different types of religious performances and so on. And in fact, for that matter, is where Lord Chaitanya instructed Sanatan Goswami and Rupa Goswami. So, this is now at the time of Krishna. Maharaj Yudhisthira is ruling. And Narada Muni is there with a whole group of great sages and saintly persons. And they are very blissful. They're having an ecstatic time together. And as sometimes happens with devotees when they get together, and they are, you know, in a little, you could say, jolly mood. They're all glorifying each other. You are the greatest devotee. You are the recipient of the Lord's greatest mercy. And then that devotee would say, no, not me. It's you. And in this way, they're going around and indicating each other and glorifying each other in a very cheerful, a very happy, transcendental spirit. Something like that. You know, devotees do that sort of thing. Maybe they were touching each other's feet and getting the dust from each other's feet. It was that sort of mood of transcendental happiness and appreciation of the other devotees. So there they were. And then, unannounced, one very prominent Brahmin devotee, who is the leader, the spiritual leader of the Prayag area, he came with his family, his servants and assistants and a whole entourage, actually. He came with all these people and personally set up a big arena for not a fire sacrifice, but for performing some deity worship. He built an altar. He smeared it with mud from the river. Then he took out a golden throne, put it on top of this just sort of, just ready-built little altar he just constructed with his own hands. And then took out his Shalagram Shila and put his Shalagram Shila on this golden throne. And then, with all his family and friends and all his entourage watching, he personally worshipped that Shalagram Shila very opulently, making offerings of food and cloth and ornaments and all sorts of things. As he was doing this, Narada Muni and all the sages and saintly people, they noticed, and they all gathered around to watch. And then other people gathered around to watch, And soon there was a lot of people watching. And this very nice Brahmin devotee, spiritual leader, very opulent Brahmin, he was doing all this worship, and in the middle, or from time to time, he would get up on his own and just sing and dance in front of the deity and carry on with the worship, different phases of the program. Then afterwards, he took all the food and all the cloth. He distributed all the cloth that he'd offered to the deity, to Narada and the other devotees, and all the various, so many people were there. He distributed all the food amongst the devotees and everybody. And even he fed everyone. He even fed all the animals. He personally fed the insects. And he made sure that every living entity who was in the vicinity was satisfied. Then when they were all satisfied, he took prasad with his family and his entourage, his assistants and other people. Then he did a very interesting thing. He went in front of his Shalagram Shila and offered some prayers. He said that whatever pious credits, whatever benefits I may have got from performing this sacrifice and all this prasadam distribution, I am offering that to you. So he offered all the benefit that he got from his food distribution program and everything to the deity, put the deity to rest, and prepared to go home. But Narada, who had been watching, he was so ecstatic at seeing the wonderful, enthusiastic, blissful way that this great devotee Brahmin, leader of the devotees, had performed this wonderful, beautiful festival. He was so inspired. He came out and he ran forward and stopped him from going and said, You are the recipient. You are the greatest recipient of the Lord's mercy. And glorified him. Now, a brief discussion ensues between Narada and this Brahmin devotee. This conversation, or at least the structure of this conversation, the basic format, is going to be repeated in every encounter that Narada Muni has. And in a sense, well, you know, at least this is an extremely important part of the message that we should get from Brihad Bhagavatamrita. Part of the message is just to hear how wonderful these different devotees are on these different levels, and to understand just from their activities as described in Brihad Bhagavatamrita, how they are very elevated and more elevated and more elevated. So that is there in a kind of self-evident way from the descriptions which are given of what they do when Narada meets them and their standard of Krishna consciousness. But really it all comes out, the message really comes out in a very graphic way in the conversations. There is a basic structure. We have written it on the board here. It begins with, generally, every time, Narada comes up to the particular devotee that he has just met and tells that devotee, You are the greatest recipient of the Lord's mercy. You have received more mercy than any other devotee. In other words, you are the greatest devotee. And Narada then explains why he feels like that. What is the evidence to support the claim that this devotee is the greatest devotee or has got the most mercy from the Lord? So that's the first part in practically every exchange. Narada explains why he thinks that, in this case, this Brahmin devotee, or whoever it is he's just met, why they are so great, so advanced. What are their qualifications? Then the second part, generally, pretty much always, is that that devotee then responds by saying, "No, no, you don't understand at all." Then, not that the devotee, usually the devotee doesn't say that, "No, I'm not the greatest recipient of the Lord's mercy. You know, there's someone who got more mercy." Generally it says, "No, I got no mercy. I got no mercy. I'm in big trouble, actually." It's like that. And then that devotee explains his or her disqualifications. And, you know, more often than not, or at least sometimes, specifically addressing the particular qualifications which Narada Muni has suggested that they have, and to show how it's not true, that either they don't have the qualification, or if they do have it, it's not a sign of mercy from the Lord, but it's a sign of, you know, that the Lord is like neglecting me, or the Lord doesn't like me. He's giving me a hard time, actually. Yeah. It's interesting. Then there's a third part, and this is always, actually. Sometimes, you know, they sort of go back and forth a little and debate certain specific details, but generally the format is along these lines. And the third part is that that person, that devotee then, suggests that, you know, if you want to know who has got the most mercy, well, it is actually such and such devotee, another devotee. And if you want to really understand this, go and see that devotee. And then that particular person who Narada is speaking to normally explains why they feel that the person they're directing Narada to has actually received the most mercy. So then Narada goes to that person, and then usually on the basis of the evidence given by the previous devotee, explains why he thinks that now this next devotee is the most advanced or has received the greatest mercy. You get the idea? Yeah. So now, Narada, he has run up. He didn't just walk up. He didn't call him over. He ran up to him. And he didn't just say, "I think you got the greatest mercy." He was very excited. "You! I've met you. I've found you. You are the greatest recipient of the Lord's mercy. And I'm so happy to have met you." And he gives reasons here. Now, just bearing in mind this concept, which appears to be, you know, sort of the basic format that Sanatana Goswami or, you know, whoever, Brihad Bhagavatamrita, Maharaj Parikshit, you know, the points they're trying to get across, You know, you should note down the different reasonings which are given. And in our tests, they will, you know, to quite some extent, focus on, you know, for example, why did Narada think that this Brahmin devotee had the most mercy? And next question might be, why did the Brahmin devotee think that he didn't have any mercy? You get the idea? So you should try and note these points down. So basically, Narada Muni, he gives two main reasons why he thinks this Brahmin devotee is the greatest recipient of the Lord's mercy. He says that you display such a high level of wealth, property, generosity, and personal opulence. Yeah, wealth, property, generosity, personal opulence. That's one reason why he thinks that this person has so much mercy. So, you know, it's pretty obvious that that is not necessarily a very sort of high manifestation of mercy from the Lord, but at least at this point, Narada Muni is saying that this is one reason why I think that you are the greatest recipient of the Lord's mercy, because you got his mercy in these ways. You're very opulent. You're very generous also with your opulence. And this is mercy. And secondly, you are using these things to establish pure religion. This is what he's using these things for. Pure religion, Sanatana Goswami explains, means for establishing devotional service, rendering devotional service. Now, our course here, our original, the version, you could say, of Brihad Bhagavatamrita we're working from, is the BBT version, which is going to be published shortly. Unfortunately, it's not published yet, so otherwise we'd be using it as the course material right now. But, you know, certain things we've taken, or everything, in fact, we've taken out of there. There's a comment that this Brahmin devotee, he was so opulent, it was sort of oozing out of him. He couldn't hide it. You know, some people who may be criminals, they get a lot of money. They don't know what to do with it. Sometimes they put it in the mattress, or they build a false wall or something, put it in the wall, or, you know, dig a hole or something like that, because they want to hide their opulence. So this Brahmin devotee, he was so opulent he couldn't hide it. It was just, you know, he was surrounded by opulence. But the comment is that he was happy to use them in devotional service. He didn't mind. He was happy to use them in devotional service. Yeah. And if you recall, we mentioned how at the end he went and offered his pious credits to the deity. So, you know, he's a very advanced devotee. But maybe he's not on the highest level of pure devotional service. He's offering his pious credits like this. So, but Narada, Narada told him, you are the greatest recipient of the mercy of the Lord because you're so opulent and you're using your opulence to promote devotional service. Then the Brahmin protested. He said that, actually I'm wretched. What charity can I give? In other words, I'm not so opulent. I can only give so much. I can't give that much. Because the opulence, Narada Muni had said, was the sign of his being the recipient of mercy. So he says, no, I haven't got so much opulence really. What charity can I give? Actually, I'm kind of wretched. I can only give a little charity. So in other words, I haven't really got so much mercy. And how can I reciprocate with the Lord? How have I ever reciprocated with the Lord? So these are his reasons that he gives for saying that he's not really received much mercy, if any mercy really, from the Lord. Then he says, you know, if you want to meet someone, if you want to see someone who really got the mercy of the Lord, I happen to know one king in South India, and he really has got the mercy of the Lord. And then he explains why. He says that the Lord is so dear to him, and he is so dear to the Lord, that the Lord has agreed to appear as the deity in a personal form, not just a shalagram shila. The Lord has appeared as a personal deity, but not just an ordinary personal deity. This personal deity is so amazing that when people look at him, they forget he's a deity. Yes. So he's got more mercy. Here, look, I've just got this shalagram shila. You may have to use your imagination a bit. But with this deity, the Lord's presence is just so vividly clear. And this king is so inspired and enthusiastic that there is a permanent festival going on in his kingdom, particularly in the main temple. Although there are many temples, so this is a second point, there is a permanent festival. It's just non-stop. And the devotees are so inspired that they are constantly improving the standard of worship because they're just inspired to do like that. And they just want to please the Lord more and more. And as a result, many saintly persons have moved there just to be there, to be with the king and to be able to enjoy the atmosphere which is there because he's the king and because he's such a nice devotee king. Then he, this king, is such a devotee. If you want to talk about generosity, giving, he is so generous. He has given legal title to the whole kingdom. There's so many temples and ashrams. He has given legal title to the deities where the temples are, to the devotees where the ashrams are, and the Brahmins. He's given legal title to all of them. And he's no longer making any claim as proprietor at all. He has handed his kingdom over. And he is existing simply as a caretaker. That's all. And because he's such a great devotee king, the land is producing crops, perfect, opulent crops, without anyone farming. The crops just grow up out of the ground. They don't plant the seeds. They don't even till the earth. They just pop up. And for the citizens are such nice devotees under his protection that whatever they want, they have. Whatever clothing, food, living accommodations, they've all got it simply because of him. And he, this king, he is completely prideless. He will do anything. There is no service too menial. And finally, that he chants and dances every day for hours in front of the deity, accompanied by all his family members and all his ministers. Yeah, they just get together in the temple and they just chant and dance all day. It's amazing. So you should go there. If you want to see someone who's opulent but not attached to the opulence, who's worshipping the Lord and who the Lord is reciprocating by showing his presence, and who is generous and prideless and detached and opulent, you know, receive the mercy of the Lord in the same ways that you think I have, but far more, it's this king. You should go to see him. So Narada, he sets off immediately to the palace of the king. So he went into the kingdom and he saw, sure enough, it's just like that Brahmin devotee said. So he goes into the palace. He runs into the palace and tells the king, it's you. You are the greatest recipient of the Lord's mercy. And he gives two main reasons. One is because your kingdom is so opulent. And, you know, bear in mind these opulences, like crops just growing spontaneously and citizens being able to get whatever opulences they needed without difficulty. These we understand generally. It's because of the king and his good rule, you know, and not his good rule, I mean, not just his good rule, but his Krishna conscious rule. There's the famous story of when Krishna went to get the sons of that Brahmin couple from Dwarka. They would have a son, the son would die immediately. But they were not doing anything wrong, so they assumed that the king was doing something wrong. Yeah. So, and therefore the Lord's mercy was being withdrawn. So, when Narada says that you're so opulent, it is not just that, you know, you're a rich man, but he's taking it as being an expression of mercy on the part of the Lord, because the king is so Krishna conscious, and therefore this opulence is coming in ways which are related to Krishna consciousness and perfect piety in a Krishna conscious context. So first reason then is because your kingdom is so opulent, and second, it's so full of saintly subjects because of you. Because of you, these people are so advanced, as they say, Bhaktivinoda Thakur said, you can tell a Vaishnav by how he can make other people Vaishnavs. So Narada is looking from that angle of vision, that your subjects are such Vaishnavs, it reflects on you. It's because you are such a Vaishnav. They have so many good qualities, personal, like their characters are so, they're such nice people. They're so pious, they're so wealthy, they're so learned, they're so devoted. Therefore, it's certain, you are the recipient of the Lord's greatest mercy. So the king disagreed. No, I'm sorry. And he gave reasons why he was not the recipient of the Lord's greatest mercy. In fact, he had not received any mercy from the Lord. He said that, I'm just a human. I only live for a few years. I'm not that, and second is, I'm not that opulent. He was not the emperor. Maharaj Yudhisthira was the emperor. Chakravarti, the emperor. He was a Maharaj. Maharaj in this context means a king over several minor kings, Rajas. This is a Maharaj. So he was that type of king. He said, I'm not really that opulent. There are other people more opulent than me. And so I'm not able to give so much in charity. He only had a limited kingdom, not unlimited kingdom. He said, I have no independence. I'm under the emperor. I'm not independent to do as I like. And I'm always in fear of death and the threefold miseries, the three modes of material nature. If I received so much mercy from the Lord, how could I be like this? In fact, he said, I don't even think that in the future I'll get any mercy from the Lord. I have none now, and I don't see how I'm going to get any in the future. So basically he said, I'm finished. I'm hopeless. I'm just useless. So then the king said that if you want to see someone who's really got some mercy, the greatest mercy, you should visit the demigods. Now, so why the demigods? He gives six main reasons. Their bodies are effulgent. They're not just these ordinary human bodies, which are not very impressive. They are effulgent. In fact, deva, this word deva, literally means effulgent. At least that's one literal meaning of the word deva. Effulgent people. They are worshipable by ordinary people like me. If I've got the greatest mercy of the Lord, why am I worshipping the demigods? He had to do that to set a good example for some of the citizens who were worshipping demigods, just as Maharaj Yudhisthira did the same thing, not because he was into demigods, but he had to set an example for some people in the kingdom who were not really devotees, so he would worship demigods. He said, they are sinless and they're fixed in goodness, therefore they're always happy. They fulfill their devotees' desires. Their food is the nectar of immortality. It's not like our ordinary food. It's a different type of substance. You eat it and you practically become immortal. Or if you drink the soma rasa, you practically become immortal. And look at me, I only live a few years. So I haven't got the mercy that they've got. And they live in heaven, which people like me can only attain by perfect piety. And I am not there right now. I am here on earth. So it means I'm not on that level yet. Yeah. So I haven't got that mercy from the Lord to live in those higher planets and have all those facilities. I'm just here on this rather crummy planet Earth. So these are the reasons that the king says he feels that not only is he not the greatest recipient of the Lord's mercy, he's got no mercy, but the demigods, they have the mercy. And final point, amongst the demigods, Indra has the most mercy. So in fact, Narada Muni will next go to meet Indra specifically. There are five main reasons he gives why Indra has more mercy. One is, he is independent. He can curse and benedict as he likes. This is an interesting point. Generally, the demigods, they can only give you your karma. Indra, he can do things, give you things against your karma. This point is made. So in that way, he is superior to the other demigods. He can curse and benedict independently, whereas the normal demigods can only give specific things when the worshippers approach them in their specific ways. He lives for such a long time, 71 cycles of the four ages. That's a long time. He has incredible paraphernalia. He has a Surabhi cow. These cows are just, well, of course, at that point, they might well think there's only one. He has a wish-fulfilling cow. He has special horse, Uchaishrava, and he has this Uchaishrava. You can find it in Bhagavad Gita. It's the name of Indra's horse. And Airavata is his elephant, who is a very special elephant. So he has this special paraphernalia headed by this unique cow, Surabhi. So therefore, obviously, he's got more mercy. At the back of his palace is the Nandana garden or Nandana forest. And there, the trees are wish-fulfilling. Yes, in Indraloka, at least in the Nandana garden, the trees are in limited ways wish-fulfilling trees. That is a fact. And they can, yeah, fulfill so many desires and assume so many forms. And fifth point, point made by the king regarding Indra. And this is a very special point. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is personally present there, not just as a very convincing looking deity, but he is personally there as Vamana, his younger brother. And he personally protects him. He personally accepts everything that Indra offers him and reciprocates with him face to face. Yeah, so you can see. Sounds like there's some more mercy there with Indra. So at this point, Narada gets ready to fly off to Swarga Loka, Indra Loka, the planet of Lord Indra. So that, in a nutshell, is what is described in the first chapter of the first part of Brihad Bhagavatamrita. Any comments or questions? Mother Rati Manjari? You are finding it strange that he's mentioning opulence? Question is that it seems perhaps strange that Narada Muni considers the opulence these people have to be a sign of mercy. Well, you know, whatever we have, even on the material platform, whatever we have is coming by the mercy of the Lord. You know, we can say, well, it's our karma, it's the Brahmin devotee's karma, it's the king's karma or Indra's karma, which is true, but at the same time it's mercy from the Lord. Yeah. But yes, I mean, there is a point there that from our understanding of Krishna consciousness, you know, even though we understand that if somehow we come into some money, it is mercy from the Lord, but the Lord can give much better mercy than that. Yeah. Even it may be a higher mercy to have everything taken away. And that point will be made in a little while by one of the devotees, that, you know, the Lord, you think that he's being kind to me by giving me all this opulence? It's a sign that he doesn't like me. If he liked me, he'd take it all away. So, you know, in a certain context of like of lower considerations, it could be said to be a type of mercy of the Lord. Yeah. You know, particularly for a devotee, if we consider a devotee, for example, to be somewhat independent or actually independent of karma, then it would be. Yeah. It would be the mercy of the Lord. But one way or the other, you know, it's a type of expression of mercy from the Lord, that the Lord is giving some facility. But it's not a very high consideration. And the next question might be, why does Narada think it is, or say it is? You know, he's Narada Muni. He's very advanced and very knowledgeable. How could he think that it is? So the obvious answer really would be that he knows that it's not. But he is, you know, he wants to like clarify things for the benefit of the audience. Yeah. So therefore he's going through this whole procedure for our benefit in the purports that point is made. Yeah. Otherwise, he knows who's the greatest devotee, who are the greatest devotees. He already knows that. But to help us, you know, see the differences between the different levels and why they're higher and why, you know, the highest devotees are the highest, he's drawing all these points out. Yeah. It is being made that Narada Muni appears to be covering his own position. He's such a great devotee. He's more advanced than any of these devotees and Indra also. So, but they're not recognizing this. Yes, that's true. And the point is made as Narada goes higher and he actually gets up amongst some really high devotees. Like in Vaikuntha, you know, and higher, then reference is made to this fact that Narada already knows these things. Why is he asking? And like this. But, you know, I think maybe the idea behind what you're talking about is that Narada, in order to help us, is trying to arrange things so that the exchanges are as real and clear as possible for our benefit. Yeah, something like that. Otherwise everyone would say, oh, you, it's you, you're Narada Muni. I mean, look at you, you're like this and like that. Something like that. Maharaj Parikshit heard the story of Brihad Bhagavatamrita from someone else. It appears he's heard it from someone else. Yeah. Although he doesn't seem to say really specifically that he's heard it from someone else, but it appears to be that he's heard it from someone else. Let me just try to research that point a little and maybe get back to it tomorrow and see what. The greatest sages, he's telling Uttara, the greatest sages have approved this resulting work. So it appears, you know, to be, although it doesn't say specifically where he may have heard it from. Your hands up, yeah? Yeah, right. That that point is made, in fact, yeah. I skipped over that point. That the Brahmin, when he's explaining that the king is a better devotee, one thing he does say is that, I'm a Brahmin. It's my duty to do all this sort of thing, puja, and so on and so forth. But the king, it's not really his duty. He just likes doing it. Spontaneously. Yeah. And just to get back to this point about where Maharaj Parikshit heard it from, that there is not a mention here of specifically where he heard it from, although he says that this work has been approved by the greatest sages. And he says, please, this is full of confidential truth, please listen with attention as I faithfully repeat it to you. So it appears he's repeating something which he's heard. Happy to use it in devotional service, but it wasn't like he had offered his whole life and himself and everything. There was... You know, this point is made in Bhagavad Gita about the difference between karma yoga and bhakti yoga, that in karma yoga there's a sense of things being mine but I offer them, but in bhakti yoga there's not really a sense of things being mine. In fact, even I am not mine. I belong to Krishna. Yeah. So that element appears to be there with the Brahmin devotee, that he was happy. You know, it's like he doesn't mind offering everything to the Lord. In fact, he's happy to offer it. And he even offers whatever benefit he got, he offers to the Lord. So there is that sense of separateness which is not so much there in pure devotional service.